Welcome once again to Cinemaholics, the major motion podcast, where we talk about the biggest and best films coming to theaters and streaming online. From the San Francisco Bay Area, I'm John Agroni, film editor for InBetweenDrafts.com. And from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, he is a freelance film writer, and he also has a part two coming out. And it's Will Ashton, the sequel.
The sequel to me?
The sequel to Will Ashton.
Oh, what's
new
this?
New and improved, more action.
Okay.
Better plot, better pacing, and I feel like Will Ashton Part 1 was nothing but setup.
Okay, so it's not a reboot or a remake, to be clear.
It's
another me, like the continuation of me.
Well, you're also a remake of your father.
In a way, yeah. That's not
And a spinoff of your mother.
Sure, yeah. I mean, would you say the same about yourself?
Yeah, we all are. Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
Applies to the human race.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was, you know, fitting, like, movies now that, like, you know, they announce, like, a release date, you know, ahead of time, you know, like, mm-hmm. It's like that kind of sets you up for, like, oh, you know, movies now, they're expected to come out, you know, this date in 2015 or 2025 or whatever. It's like, just like when you're a baby. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I'll let you
it's late
jump
where you
in
are.
At any
you're
point.
Just kinda, yeah. I just wanted to let you I won't call that cooking, but it's something. All right. You're heating something up. We're happy to be back. And, you know, for folks who are not listening to this in the future, yeah, we had to take a little bit of a break and, you know, some just difficulties with, like, the scheduling. And I got to say, it a little sad. You know, we missed our Oscars conversation. We still have to talk about our favorite movies of 2023. Mm. At this point, it is March. And we're pretty late on Dune.
Sure.
It took a while just to get the Madam Web episode out. So hoping for things to tighten up here soon.
Mean,
it's been a sporadic couple of months, that's for sure.
I feel like, not to put you on the spot, but I feel like it's mostly been, hey, I'm game to record, when do you want to do it? And you're like, maybe March 17th. And you're like, okay, I was hoping for sooner, but that's an option, I suppose. And you're like, how about the 27th? It's like, well, okay.
How about Duner? But no, here we are now. And hey, we're a little bit like Dune. We got delayed. Dune Part 2. And I think that, you know, it hasn't been that long, technically, since we talked about Dune Part 1. And that was a movie that, I'll let you speak for yourself. For me, I was kind of disappointed. I didn't come out with the knives for Dune Part 1. I wasn't like, there's anything significantly wrong with this movie. I think for me, Dune Part 1, I was a little bit left like, that wasn't a movie. That was the first part of something. And I was feeling like it didn't stand on its own. But I could appreciate the little details of it. I could appreciate what Denis Villeneuve was doing. I had a similar reaction to it that I've had to some of his work. I'm a big fan of him in general. I think Blade Runner 2049 is a true sci-fi masterpiece. And Arrival's kind of grown on me. I didn't like that one as much as most people. And I would say a lot of his other movies, like Sicario and Enemy and all those, like, really solid, really, like, just they deliver. Dune Part 1, I was like, well, I'll reserve my full judgment for Dune Part 2. And I remember you, I vaguely remember this, correct me if I'm wrong, you liked Dune Part 1, right?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was a very, very cool theatrical experience, first and foremost. I mean, you know, this was back in, what, 2021?
Yeah.
When theaters were just kind of very gradually opening up again. Well, I guess they were open, but people were going back to movies very gradually again.
The film release schedule wasn't super consistent at this point, and that summer had been a little bit like,
sure. And, you know, this is also 2021, the year where Warner Brothers was putting all their movies on what was once known as HBO Max. So it is funny to think back and, like, remember that this movie, like, or the first Dune, rather, was available on Max. Like, and a lot of people, I'm sure, watched it that way, but I think there was something comforting about people willfully being like, no, this is for the theaters, we should see this on the biggest screens, we should see this the way the director intended it to be seen. And, you know, it became, I don't want to say it's like the next big sci-fi or science fiction, fantasy, whatever you want to call it, franchise, but it feels like the biggest of this kind, probably, maybe, like, I know it's like a fantasy, but maybe since Lord of the Rings? Like, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like...
Nah.
It's hard to say because Star Wars and, like, all these other things are continuations. And this is, like, another adaptation of a classic, you know, pivotal, influential sort of text in a way, like something like John Carter didn't really take off, but Dune has been a big franchise starter.
I think so. For me, if you're talking Lord of the Rings, there are many reasons, great reasons to compare these movies. Yes. I would say that we have gotten water cooler sci-fi and fantasy. It's just they haven't, to your point, they've mainly been on the smaller screen. They've been things like Game of Thrones, right? There's been plenty of stuff like that that has taken off. It's just, in terms of like a cinematic thing, I'm of two minds of this. When it comes to the success of the first Dune, on the one hand, I think that yes, Warner Brothers was always motivated to kind of return to the format that I think you and I prefer. Put it out in theaters, make it exclusive so people go out and they watch it. It's an event, right? And, you know, you and I are interested in that for the artistry of it all. Just like the fact that it's a better way to experience these movies. It's a better way to kind of appreciate and respect the filmmakers. But another thing is it's better for the industry. Like, let's just say it. It's just financially smarter. You know, people will pay money to go to a place to watch a movie and have that experience. A price that they're not necessarily as willing to pay, right? The premium at home or for a streaming service. And I think that the way the streaming bubble has kind of ebbed, bursted, refilled, and bubbled out again and whatever over the last several years has kind of shown these companies that, like, we cannot all be Netflix, and Netflix doesn't even want to be Netflix. Mm-hmm. Netflix wants to get in on, you know, the theater game to some extent, at least for rewards.
Yeah. I mean, there is something to be said about both Dune movies kind of chronicling the fall and the further fall of streaming, in the sense that, like, obviously 2020 was the biggest year for streaming just because everyone was homebound. They were starved for content or for films or art. And obviously a lot of people invest a lot of interest into streaming being the next big thing. And to some extent it was, but you know, like when you see something like Dune be available on streaming the same day it's in theaters, and people for the most part choosing to see in theaters. And obviously I'm not going to say this was the case for every film of that year. Obviously the Max strategy was a disaster because most of those movies were either just not seen at all or seen on Max as opposed to in theaters. But it does feel like kind of a tides are turning situation. And now we're seeing Dune Part 2 be one of the first major film events of this kind outside of like Avatar or Top Gun Maverick. Like, obviously, these are all sequels that we're referring to, but it does kind of feel like something that's more exclusive to the now as opposed to like an IP, you know, like a sequel to something that came out 10, 20, 30 years ago, even though this is obviously an adaptation of a book from, you know, back in
1965. Yeah, Frank Herbert's book.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but that brings me to my other mind of it, though, which is that I do think that while we agree the HBO Max strategy of releasing these things at the same time in 2021 was a disaster, it lost them a lot of money, but there were some positives that came out of it. It was not a fully, like, full-on only negatives. There were things that they predicted that would happen that would benefit some of the IP. That certainly was the case, which is a lot of people who would not have seen Dune Part 2 did show up to watch Dune Part 2 because they saw Dune Part 1. Because of the ease of the availability. That's not to say that they wouldn't have stumbled across it anyway when it would hit a streaming service, but I do think that, like, that initial wave of it did draw in a lot of interest. It's a trick. It's like a little thing that could not work again. Like, I don't think they could do this same sort of thing again and expect the same result. So I don't think they have the appetite for it anyway, thank goodness. But it is a very unique thing where I think a lot of the success of Dune Part 2 is the fact that it didn't have a traditional release in 2021. Couple that with the fact that when it did come out in 2021, the competition wasn't nearly as bad. You know, like, we're still talking about an era when around this time, this was October 2021, right after that, something like, for example, Encanto comes out, right? I think that was 2020. Actually, that might have been 2022. But even if it was 2022, it was 2021, because 2022 is when that movie kind of broke out, right? And Encanto, when it hit theaters, crickets. People didn't show up. But then a month later, it did hit Disney Plus. The Bruno song became a huge phenomenon. And then that's where they started getting Encanto, like, revenue from all the other streams, right? No pun intended. But for Dune Part 1, I think you kind of had a similar effect. But again, it's not sustainable because, like, it got the popularity, but Dune Part 2 is where they needed the money to kind of come in so that, like, I think there is a reason why Denis Villeneuve, like, they, Part 3 wasn't greenlit yet. I don't even know if it's greenlit at this point. Do you know?
Dune Messiah, you mean? Dune Part 3?
Dune Part, yeah.
I think it's, like, in the works, but I don't think there's been, like, an official announcement.
Okay, yeah, I think that they have to have done some pre-production work, but yeah, it's not a case of Lord of the Rings where they're filming everything back-to-back, nor I don't think they necessarily need to in this case because of the nature of the way the film's being made. But anyway, that's all to say.
Sure.
Dune Part 2 is out, and mm-hmm. it was originally supposed to come out this past November, so mm-hmm. kind of similar to the last release, be a kind of a holiday thing. It probably would have like just cleaned house at the Oscars, almost by default, but it didn't. It's qualifying for this year, much to Oppenheimer's, you know, what's the opposite of delight? I was going to say dismay, but Oppenheimer won a lot of awards it probably would not have if Dune Part 2 had come out in 2023. I think that's a strong case to make, honestly, yes.
It's hard to say. I don't know. I feel like weirdly it would have hurt Barbie more than Oppenheimer because they're both Warner Brothers. Sure. Yeah.
But I mean, I think Dune Part 2 and Oppenheimer kind of inhabit a similar space. And in terms of like these different movies and where they kind of interact in the broader Oscar voter mind, I think Barbie is a very specific thing that some Oscar voters are very passionate about. A movie like Oppenheimer, I think Christopher Nolan and Denis Villeneuve are like a certain type of auteur filmmaker, like a big budget blockbuster auteur filmmaker, which is a very specific and rare thing, especially these days, that I think that would have probably been more of a competition. Very interesting competition too, because I think two great movies, just to get it out there, I'm a big fan of Dune Part 2, and I think to slide into that conversation, this movie, I think, honestly, as I was saying before, it is finally kind of delivering a lot of payoff to what I wanted from Dune Part 1. And it, if anything, it makes me, it's not that I appreciate Dune Part 1 a little bit more, it's more so that, like, I'm a little annoyed that I had to sit through all of Dune Part 1 to get to this, because I am coming from the perspective of someone who is familiar with the story already and the books and everything, and kind of wanted there to just be more of like a movie of it. Like, just get to the, like, the real themes, the real messages, and how they actually like fulfill everything. So I'm a big fan of this movie. It's a continuation of Part 1. It picks up right after Part 1. The praise has been big. The, like, critics, you know, we'll do the Rotten Tomatoes game, but I think, Will, you are aware, critics like this movie quite a bit. Big budget, $109 million budget, but it's already raked in almost $500,000. It is bona fide success. But what did you think, Will? Did are you kind of like in the same line as me where you're just like, wow, this is really great? Or are you kind of looking at this like more like, you know, Dune Part, try again? We need a take two for Part 2.
Okay, there you go. That's a little bit better than whatever that first attempt was.
It took me a second. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I liked it. I feel like maybe my expectations were set a little too high for this one, in the sense that, you know, like, I had been halfway through the book when I saw the first movie. I really liked the way that movie was able to kind of let you live in that universe, I think, a little bit better than this movie, where I think there's a busyness to it that is understandable, but it's also kind of a hindrance for what I think Dune is really about, which is, like, obviously there's a whole, like, you know, space messiah turned space Hitler sort of thing that happens in Frank Herbert's book, and obviously gets a little bit more developed in this film in a more traditional, narratively satisfying way as opposed to the first movie. But at the same time, I feel like for as much as this movie has been extended and allowed to be its own thing by being a whole other film, there is a sense that I feel like a lot of the story kind of felt a little truncated to me. Like, I felt like some of the characters, like Salazar, the Javier Bardem character, and even Lady Jessica, the Rebecca Ferguson character, felt...
It's not Salazar, it's Stilgar.
Stilgar.
I'll double check.
Salazar is his character in Pirates of the Caribbean, is that right?
I was going to say, that does sound familiar. Yeah, it's Stilgar for Javier Bardem.
Sorry. But anyway, my apologies. And obviously, I think, you know, both are very good performances. I really didn't take any issue with the acting of the film, nor did I really take any issue with the production of the film. I think it's all super accomplished. I mean, as a pure feat of just, you know, blockbuster filmmaking, something of this scale, size, it's obviously going to be impressive in its own way, especially when it's done with confidence and with grace, as I feel Villeneuve's films often are. But at the same time, I don't know. I do like the film. I had a good time watching it. I can see why it's becoming the sort of new great blockbuster sci-fi epic for a lot of people, especially younger people. But at the same time, I don't know, it left me wanting something a little bit more defined, I guess. I just kind of felt like they sanded off, more so with than the first movie, a lot of the edges with this, in the sense of, like, I know that for Dune to be palatable to a mainstream audience, you kind of have to reduce some of the weirdness of it and make it a little bit more engaging or a little bit more understandable to a wide audience. But it just kind of felt like a lot of things got sacrificed in the sense of making this a little bit more, I don't know, like expected, I guess, a little bit more, I don't want to say bland, but like a little bit more, I don't know, maybe generic to some extent. But for as much as I really love some details about, especially Austin Butler's performance, which I think is really where the movie comes alive for me, is when he's on the screen. I don't know. It did make me want a little bit more, which I feel is a little greedy, but I do like the film. I'll say that one more time. But
yeah, you want to be careful. Austin Butler doesn't come for you with those knives.
But I'm still kind of working through like why this wasn't like a slam dunk for me. It's more like a third base thing than a home run for me. And I'm not 100% sure why yet, and I'm still working through it. But yeah, it's a good film.
Third base is still really good. So yeah, that's easy to take to heart there. Yeah, for me, I got everything that I wanted, you know, and everybody comes into movies wanting different things. That's the for sure aspect of this. But I think for me, what I wanted out of this movie more than anything else was just the point to really start to take fruition. I think there is an advantage to these movies as an adaptation beyond the obvious stuff, which is like, yes, you get to see it in live action. You get to see the costumes. You get to see the worms. You get to feel the epic scale of the books amplified in a cinematic setting. That is the whole point of adaptation. It's why we do this. It's why adaptation can be a wonderful thing when done correctly. And, you know, it's not as easy as doing something correctly. Sometimes there's a lot of luck to it, too. There's sort of like an invisible, you know, science to it that nobody can always 100% guarantee will work. In the case of this movie, I come out of it feeling like they actually, like Denis Villeneuve, he has a co-writer for this too. I'll double check the name here. It's John Spates. What they're able to do is they're able to take something about the books that was complained about, which is that this is another chosen one kind of story, that this is like the Messiah thing. It's kind of glorifying a white savior and all of that. And Frank Herbert, I think, that he wrote more books kind of in response to that, very famously was like, I really want to make sure people get the point that this is a cautionary tale. It is a meta-awareness tale about this kind of trope. And I think that is the thing where I was like, if you can do that well, you have me hooked, because I think the Chosen One trope is overdone. I think that there is still something interesting to do with it. And that's kind of where this movie kind of strikes a chord with me. Because there is a way to get this wrong, where it's like, if you're too preachy about it, it does start to make you dislike Paul Atreides, played by Timothy Chalamet, too much. And I was very, very trepidatious about how this movie would handle this part of the story, based on the fact that I have found Timothy Chalamet to be a little hit or miss. And I there have been times where I'm like, I don't get why this guy is like kind of, you know, glorified as much as he is, when I think that he has high highs and low lows for me. I think Call Me By Your Name, which, you know, I actually kind of mentioned briefly before we started recording. I think that he's wonderful in that movie. I think that is a brilliant performance. It's a performance that sticks with you, especially the final, you know, credits.
That might still be his best performance, I think, at least for me.
It just might well be. But there have been other movies he's been in. What was that one? Boy Erased. Ben is back. When Ben came back.
No, wait, no, that's Lucas Hedges, right? Ben is back with Julia Roberts.
Boy Erased is Lucas Hedges. Oh,
No. Ben is back, I think, also has. Isn't that Lucas Hedges?
I'm looking it up because I refuse.
It's made by Lucas Hedges' father, right? Isn't that why?
Okay, yes, you are right. You're right. But Boy Erased also is Lucas Hedges. But this is what I mean. But no,
Boy Erased is Joel Edgerton, right?
Who is what?
sorry. Okay, so Peter Hedges, I believe, is the director of Ben is Back. With Ben is Back.
Beautiful Boy. That's what I was thinking of.
Beautiful Boy. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. So many boys.
In
boys
my defense, these movies came out around the same time. But no, Beautiful Boy. And then there were other movies like The King. There was stuff like... I didn't like him in Little Women at all. Like, I think Little Women is almost a perfect movie for me, except for him. I can't stand him in that movie. And I don't think he's that great in Lady Bird. But... I love me some Wonka. I know.
See, that's...
Controversial.
I feel like we're kind of opposites, where it's like, I think Wonka works kind of in spite of Timothée Chalamet, but I really like him in Lady Bird, and I really like him in Call Me By Your Name and Little Women and stuff. Like,
well,
I think
like
he really
Call
works
by
in
your
those
name,
movies.
Of course. Well, and I will say, but Bones and All was a movie that I really, really liked his performance, like a lot.
Oh, yeah, so he's great in that.
I think if not, I think he and Taylor Russell, like, I mean, just one of the most like, like that on-screen chemistry is just like something else. But
sure, yeah.
Anyway,
him and Luca Guadagnino, yeah, they do magic together, which is making me very excited about Challengers, not because he's in it, but because Zendaya's in it. And I feel like if there's any weak link in Dune Part 2, it might be her. Not because of her character, but I think her performance is maybe a little bit lesser than...
I think she's
the cast, which
brilliant
is all, like,
in this movie. No okay. way. I cannot disagree more. I think she is the key to this movie being that extra level for me. Like, it for me, it comes down to her. This movie does not work unless her. Because so much of the Timothée Chalamet performance kind of hinges on how she reacts in real time to what's going on in the world around her, not just with him, but with this situation. And I think if there's one thing about this character that like really sticks out to me, it's yes, she is a character whose agency is a little confusing at times, and it can be something to poke at.
Mm-hmm. I think her agency is much, much better in this film than it was either in the book or in the David Lynch film.
I couldn't agree more with that.
Yeah. Chani is much, much more well-defined. And I take no issue with how she's written, to be clear. And I don't really even take that much issue with Zendaya's performance. I just feel like she's the weakest of a pretty much all-star cast. But keep going. I don't want to dispel.
That's how I feel about Florence Pugh. I think Florence Pugh in this movie is kind of anonymous. And that is, I think part of it is because we've seen Florence Pugh do such brilliant work before that I think in this one, I'm like, it's kind of a yawn for me. I think that it's not her fault. I just think the writing for her, again, it's like Dune Part 1. It's like, when does the interesting stuff with her character happen?
I mean, I'm just going to kind of assume that they're going to have to add more to her for Doom Messiah. Because, like, I really, like, for as much as we can nitpick Chani and the way she's written in the books and has been portrayed, like, I can't even remember Princess Irana, or I forget the...
Irulan, I think is how, Irulan, I don't know how to say it, but yeah.
Yeah, but, like, yeah, she is, like, almost a near non-entity, besides one pivotal point at the end of the film. In the book, so it's like a really hard character to like make fully function unless you like change the character almost entirely, which would be near impossible for the story that's being told here. So I think that's an unenviable job on Florence Pugh's part, and I think she gives it as much dramatic gravitas as she can. But I can get what you're saying. I can see why that performance of any of these may be the one that doesn't work for you.
I don't understand why Christopher Walken is in this movie. I don't.
Oh, best part.
Not that I'm unhappy to see him. The casting doesn't make sense to me. And
oh, totally disagree. He's the best part about this movie. Oh, 100%. Well, for
all
what?
Power to you. I don't see it. I'm just like, okay. It's distracting to me. I don't see a character there. I just see the actor collecting a paycheck.
Oh, wow.
And I do not understand what he's doing in this movie. I don't see him.
Wow.
Really? There is no connection between the characters for me at all. And
this might be the most we've disagreed on something since Beau's Afraid.
He's not in enough of the movie for it to bother me, like for the whole, to like judge the whole movie. But every single time he came on screen, I was like, what? Like, it looks to me like he rolled out of bed and they just like put a shirt on him and he memorized the lines that day.
All right. I don't even know where to begin, but okay. First things first. I don't know if it's coincidental or intentional, but I feel like the casting for Christopher Walken was because of the Weapon of Choice music video, right? Because that, like, the whole thing in Weapon of Choice is, you know, they quote Dune, like, you know, walk without rhythm and it won't upset the word. The worm.
Are you sure that's not just a coincidence?
It could be, but I don't think that's something that was on Christopher Walken's mind, but I have to assume that at least one of the producers had that in mind. But no, I think
it was on your mind, that's for sure.
No, I think the Emperor, it's so integral for him to be the sort of, like, larger than life, but also, like, not entirely unreadable, but, like, the sort of grandiose enigma sort of character, yeah. But, like, what I love about Chris Rockin's performances is, for one, I feel like Villeneuve actually makes it a real performance. Like, I feel like he's someone who, I mean, I still need to catch up on Severance, but I feel like of late, whenever he does get to walk, when he gets to act, I mean, Christopher Walken has been defined more by his quirks and, like, a series of kind of, like, eccentric qualities that don't really always define a character. And that's just because people, especially in the 2000s, I think kind of just latched onto his, like, you know, way of speaking and just kind of, you know, Walkenisms and stuff. But this feels like a fully fleshed out performance in a way that I feel like we haven't seen, especially on this scale, from Christopher Walken in a long time. And the world weariness and the strain and the, like, sense of displacement that I think he brings to the character is just really well defined. Yeah, he's absolutely outside of the worms, which I think it should go without saying, but any Dune movie, the best thing about it are the worms. And I love the worms, and every time the worms come on screen, there's a big smile on your buddy Will Ashton's face. But
fortunately, yeah, we agree on that. Thank goodness we do agree on that.
Chris Rock, I think, is quite easily second best thing about this movie. I have to entirely disagree with everything you said negatively about him.
It's just a plain disagreement between the two of us. We've each made our cases. I will just say that at least when it comes to Severance, that is a tough thing to beat. I mean, his whole role in that show is just something else entirely. I couldn't stop thinking about it for weeks and weeks after I finished the first season. I can't wait for the second. But anyway. Rebecca Ferguson, still really good in this. I think that she is just one of the reasons I liked the first one as much as I did. I think she's a big kind of focal point of that movie. Still has a role here, but not as big, not as, like, dramatically big. Josh Brolin, still great. And I think Stellan Skarsgård just, like, he just feasts on this role. I do think that there are Dave Bautista, his role works. I like what happens with him as a character. I feel a little bad for him getting stepped on as much as he does in this movie. But it ultimately works to the movie's benefit.
I think he's really come into his own as an actor. The way that he's portrayed in the film can feel a little one note. And I don't blame him for that. I think it does kind of feel like,
yeah,
just be angry all the time in this movie in a way that, like, I think that's where the split kind of hurts the story a little bit, in the sense, like, I think that character would have felt maybe a little bit more well-rounded if this was, like, one story, but splitting into two, like, you kind of just get the, like, he's angry in this part. So it makes the character for this film at least seem a little one note, but I think he does well with what he can.
I agree. There are a couple, like, fun little cameos in this that I wasn't expecting. I won't give them away, but I guess a lot of people will know that they're in this. Javier Bardem, kind of touched on him before, but man, I think that he pulls off something really interesting here, which is he's able to, like, add, he's a comic relief, and in a movie that I just wasn't expecting, like, humor to really work, and there's not a lot of it, but, like, it shows up with him, and it really works for me in this movie. And I've seen some people disagree with this. Some people be like, yeah, you know what? It didn't quite match for me. Other people are like, those are some of my favorite parts of the movie, because, like, if it's one character, it doesn't break the immersion, because you're like, yeah, that's kind of this character. It's just kind of funny, like, what's happening with his character. And I've seen some memes coming out of it that are really fun. And I don't know, it brought a simple smile to my face. And it really looked to me like Javier Bardem had a lot of fun with this role.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's one of the few things, like, these two films being made separately as opposed together, you do see Villeneuve kind of took the note of, like, lighten up a little bit, buddy. Like, it feels like they're actually, like you said, there are jokes in this one. Like, in the first one, it's maybe a little too, you know, straight faced for its own good. It does kind of feel like this one at times is allowed to be a little bit looser as far as, you know, like, the tone of it goes, at least. Maybe not in story, but I don't want to discount, like, because Josh Brolin also gets a few, like, more lighthearted moments in this, I think, comparatively, at least. But I do have to say, as far as the comedic beats go, I feel like there are some unintentional laughs I got out of Javier Bardem this time around, just because the way that his character is written throughout is just like every other line of his is just like a character will be like, ah, oh, geez, like, ah, I have to go make a big mess in my still suit. I had too much sand. As written. Like every single line is as was written. Or it is told and it is written. Like there'd be a wonderful drinking game to be had.
Yeah.
About every time he says it is written or as it was written or as it was foretold or however, like I feel like it got comical in that respect.
But you know what? I think one of the reasons it does work for me is because a kind of crucial thing about this movie, not to give anything away, is that you have to buy the sort of ascent of Paul Atreides as this Messiah character for this movie to work, right? And I think a lot of it does hinge on Stilgar, kind of hinges on like why he becomes so fanatical about this character and whether or not the movie can actually sell the connection between that and the rest of the Fremen without making the Fremen feel too monolithic. I don't think the movie does that perfectly. I don't think it's super graceful. I think that it allows a little bit of room for that friction, but because it is a movie, it does sort of shortcut a lot of that stuff in a way that the books, they do have like a richer sense of like what Paul has to do in order to become who he becomes, right? The movie does it kind of like in a quickened pace. I think it ultimately works the movie's favor because that serves the spectacle, and then it doesn't feel like it's like dragged down by never-ending plot, and it kind of gets to the point a little bit faster, and I think that works for adaptation. I think this movie is one of those rare cases where I actually do think if you read the book already, there's a lot to really love here, especially because there's stuff that I do expect that some people will be able to totally follow, at least on the first watch. A lot of like little details of like how this universe works and how things in general with this universe works, that if you do have that foundation with the movies or with the books, I suspect it's easier. And I think, I don't know where you're at with that, because I know you're familiar with the story too. So we can't really speak to that.
I think you're probably right. And, you know, I think there is something really commendable to be said here about the way that Villeneuve made the story accessible to a wide audience, a way that, you know, I mean, if you look at like what David Lynch did with his film, or if you watch the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune and just see, even though in some respects, like, would that have been a definitive film? Maybe, but like, I don't know what universe that movie would have been made. Obviously, it didn't get made in this one, but, you know, I think it's very hard to make a story like this, you know, which is like, you know, it's fairly out there and absurd. And like, if you're reading the book, you have to like, get used to all these weird terminologies and like have to like kind of flip back and forth between the you know, like the made up dictionary in the back and in the book,
yeah,
and
yeah,
kind of, you know, kind of get yourself acquainted with all these weird terms and stuff. But I think the high point of the book reading it for me is like when you get maybe about like halfway through or two thirds of the way through, you've kind of understood most of the terminology and stuff, and you just kind of just feel immersed in the just, I don't want to say spectacle because it's a book, but like just the experience of it all and the way you're just kind of taken in by it. And I think that's something that with the quick and pace here and the like kind of expedience and the way that they're telling the story, I think gets a little lost. But there is something to be said about like the way that Villeneuve was able to transfer a lot of these things that just seem so esoteric and so unable to be translated to film in a way that feels very accessible and very well realized, while not feeling shortened to an extent where it's like he's taking away the power or the spectacle, as you mentioned, of the story. I think it is an achievement to be sure, and I think there's a lot of good things to be said about it. But again, I just find myself, I don't know, just feeling like it could have just used a little bit more pulp. Like I think it just needed a little bit more, pun intended, spice. Like I think it just needed something maybe a little bit more willing to be a little bit more absurd. And maybe that's Warner Brothers. I don't know. But I feel like there is something gained and something lost by making it this accessible, but also, you know, this palatable to a mainstream audience.
I don't know. I think you're underselling some of the weirdness that does happen in this movie. For me, I think they strike the balance really, really well. Maybe it could have been a little bit better. We will never know, I guess. But I think that for what we got, I mean, I did see the movie twice. And the second time, to what you're saying, there's a certain point in the books, and I agree, it just feels like the gears of this world start turning, And it feels like everything that happens does have this cause and effect. And you feel engrossed. You're like, what's going to happen next? Like, how is this action? Because you're so sold on like actions causing each other. And I was feeling that in this movie in a way that I was not in Dune Part One. And I think that that is a major reason for like why I was able to get, you know, that kind of similar experience, because it just really clicked. It really fell into place. And I do think that there are so many like weird things that happen in the books and in the movies. And it's like Villeneuve somehow found a way, and Greg Fraser too, and of course Hans Zimmer, between the music, the visuals, everything feels connected. It all just feels like it's alive and it does make sense and exists in this universe in ways where times in the books where I'm like, this feels arbitrary. This just kind of feels like a weird thing that Frank Herbert came up with because, you know, for whatever reason. And I think that it's nice to see that you can still take something that was so influential. You mentioned John Carter, right? That is something that was so influential for its time. It inspired a wave of pulp and fiction that, you know, led to some of the great, you know, 20th century kind of like, you know, myths and things like that. John Carter really set that kind of portal fantasy kind of thing up in a very revolutionary way. But they try to make a John Carter movie. It's hard. It's hard when you take like the kind of like OG. And Dune, in a lot of ways, for Frank Herbert, it's the OG when it comes to what if we took like sci-fi, this kind of like Isaac Asimov, like really fun, grounded sci-fi. My personal favorite kind of sci-fi is Asimov sci-fi. And you kind of fuse it with like a Middle Eastern vibe, right? And something that kind of like is steeped in, you know, like, you know, Islam and kind of like these like very specific things that you wouldn't think, like it's very imaginative to put these two things together. For us, it's not as imaginative in 2024 because of Dune, we get things like Star Wars, right? We get so many things following out of Dune and then Star Wars and then inspirations from Star Wars and so on and so on. So getting Dune right is so difficult, and I respect so much that they actually have pulled it off, like that they have made a movie that is striking a chord and working for so many people. And for some people like me, and just like hitting it out of the park, that's just a cool thing to see.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think above all else, it's a good film, and it's a really, really cool theatrical experience, and I'm not trying to shortchange that. I do really recommend, I mean, obviously, by this point, a lot of people have seen in theaters, but if you can see, especially in Dolby or IMAX, as I believe, I was able to see in Dolby. I don't
so
know
great
if you saw
in IMAX.
It.
Oh my gosh.
Just, you know, the sound alone, you know, it just makes it so, so immersive and so cool. But yeah, I mean, you know, for whatever nitpicks, and certainly have a few at this point, I mean, it is almost unfathomable to realize that this movie works as well as it does. So I don't want to discredit that aspect of it. But yeah, I don't know. I still have my quibbles. I'm going to keep my quibbles.
But yeah, I would definitely say, so I did see it Dolby the second time, IMAX the first time. IMAX is a superior way to see it, but both are going to be great. Let's read some comments here. These are here's a little mini review from Fran. I know you're a fan of Fran. You and Fran, you stan Fran. Fran gave it 2.5 stars. So, you know, I disliked it, it looks like. So not quite up to your opinion because you liked it, but maybe there's something here that you might agree with. But okay.
She was 3 out of 5 before, so I guess her rating went down.
I haven't seen that must be. She said, very okay. Big step down from the first. I don't think it necessarily requires the same level of awe and scale, but I found relatively little awe and scale here at all. Dramatically so stayed despite all of the climactic action. I appreciated Bardem, Butler, and Ferguson making interesting, unexpected choices within what felt like a very narrow scope of vision. Surprisingly moved to see Walken looking so regal. That first hour felt really interminable, frustrating experience mostly. Yeah, I don't agree with it much of this at all. I will say, first hour is not my favorite. I think similar to kind of something you brought up, the Austin Butler stuff, once that came into the movie, from then on, I was just like nonstop loving it. That was, and I love that whole aside. Everything with like the Austin Butler stuff, the gladiator fight scene, I was totally gripped.
Yeah, I mean, his whole little aside with Lea Seydoux, it's so fun to me.
So funny.
It's this weird, like, kind of sexy, kind of gross, just kind of bizarre but captivating little back and forth. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I kind of wish the movie, like, I guess that's what you're kind of alluding to by some of the weirder things that might creep up into the film. And And funny enough, that's like one of the things that I think the movie diverges away from the book from, if I recall, because I don't really remember that being in the book, but I could obviously have forgotten it. But
yeah, I don't remember. It has been a while.
Yeah,
I have the book right behind me. Let's pop it up.
But
you yeah, actually can see it on my video now that I think about it. It's like right by my head.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I mean, I agree with maybe small parts of that. I think I had more fun watching the first movie because it kind of felt like it was more about the vibes and just being immersed in this odd little futuristic world in a way that I feel like I kind of wish this movie had the capability of being allowed to have like some of those breathier moments. I'm not going to go out and say that it's the better of the two. I think they're more or less on the same page for me at this point. But I think there is something to be said about like there's a spontaneity and boldness to Butler's performance that I feel like I wish the movie allowed its other actors to kind of have that more readily, you know, because even like Christopher Walken, in my opinion, at least, is pretty reined in an effective way. But like, you know, even like the most like, you know, famously eccentric actors kind of feel honed in a way that Butler is able to kind of go big and broad and in a way that I found myself very drawn to and kind of sold him on me in a way that like, you know, because before, like, you know, it's like, well, he's like good in like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I really liked him in Elvis, but it's just like a kind of one trick pony thing. And then I watch this movie and I'm like, no, Butler's like the real deal. Like he's not just, you know, like the flavor of the week sort of thing. Like he's going to become a really interesting young actor.
Interesting is the right word. Yeah. Cause I think that he chooses his projects really well.
Sure.
And he commits. I mean, Elvis, he committed so hard to that movie. And I think like that press tour is really what kind of sold me on this guy.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think it's better than Fran's giving it credit, to be sure, but I can understand at least some of her complaints.
There weren't a lot of negative reviews I found that were, you know, as well said as that one, where I really got a sense of like why the movie didn't work for the person. This is a much more positive review. This is from Buddy O. Buddy said, Denis Villeneuve is arguably one of the best working directors right now. Dude keeps pumping out bangers. Javier Bardem ups his game and is absolutely hilarious and a standout for me. The music is so effing good and makes these movies. I get literal chills every single time. Super excited to see where it goes. The lore keeps getting way more interesting. Anyone else think Austin Butler looks like those Photoshop celebrity pictures with no teeth? I did think that Austin Butler, I was like, why is the Splice monster from Splice in this movie? There was like a fun little, I could not stop thinking about that for a good minute there. I do want to like echo the music one more time. I just think the music is just, oh my gosh. It's so perfect. Like, and I do love the jokes where people are like kind of like wailing the like to the music doing like random mundane things. But that kind of speaks that it's like, it's kind of one of a kind. Like it's such a unique vibe for the music that I just, whenever there were times it was getting a little loud and I was like, oh my gosh, turn down my hearing aids. But it makes so many scenes for me because I feel it. Like I just feel like I'm there. I feel like I'm supposed to feel what I'm supposed to be feeling. It's so emotionally manipulative and I love it for that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I have too much more else to say about the score, but I mean, it's rare that you see a movie like this and you can close your eyes and get maybe almost as much out of the film as you would, you know, seeing it with your eyes open. But, you know, it's good point. Yeah, it's really cool.
I want to say, too, with Rebecca Ferguson, because I forgot to mention this, really good in Silo. I think Silo, the Apple TV show, I know you haven't seen it because you don't believe Apple TV exists.
Yeah, yeah.
Here we go. But no, Silo is really good. And also based on a book, so it's a sci-fi kind of thing, and I have the book right behind me as well. But she's pretty terrific in that show. But okay, so this is from somebody that I know in real life, a good friend of mine, Lexi. Lexi said, it feels like Denis Villeneuve has been waiting his entire life to make these movies. You can just feel how passionate he is about Frank Herbert's Dune. A lot of times when someone adapts a novel that's already been adapted numerous times, it feels like they're only doing it because it's easier than coming up with an original idea or it's merely a lifeless cash grab. But it genuinely feels like Villeneuve grew up being obsessed with these books and honed his skills as a filmmaker so he can make the Dune movies he's always dreamed of. I don't know if that's true. I could be. I don't know if Villeneuve is like a legit fan. To me, I wouldn't be surprised either way. If Lexi's right here and it's like he's like a super fan with Dune, I haven't watched or listened to any interviews with him. I would buy that. Like, yeah, sure. Like, he clearly seems to have a passion. But if he honestly was just like, yeah, I didn't read these books for the first time until I signed on to do this movie, I would buy that too. Because I just think that he's like a genuine kind of artist, and I think that he can take anything and find a way with it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I feel. Do you know something I don't know?
I feel like, and I very well could be wrong, because this is going off of quotes I remember hearing like 3 years ago, but I thought I remember when the first Dune movie came out, him saying that, like, basically doing Dune was like his white whale, like kind of like his dream project that he never knew if he could do, but like always wanted to do. So I feel like that is
okay.
What Lexi is saying, I feel like, is true. I could be wrong. Like I said, I haven't read anything about that recently. So, but I feel like he said something along those lines when the first movie came out. So I think there is something to be said about that. And I do think it's undeniable when you see, you know, just some of the environments and the way that this movie is really, really smart about using special effects in a grounded, believable way where everything feels so palatable, and the mix of like practical and real effects, you know, it really puts to shame. Like, you know, if you watch like this movie and then watch like Ant-Man and the Wasp, like Quantumania, it's like, and just compare budgets, it's like, this is a joke. Like, you know, like this movie looks 100 times better than like your average blockbuster, you know, at least nowadays. But yeah, I mean, I think there is something to be said about maybe he's a little too formalist to really, like I said, capture some of the eccentricities I think should be apparent in Dune. But I don't deny that like his inspiration, his passion for the project bleeds into every frame of this film.
Absolutely, absolutely. One last for us here. This is from Corey Everett. He's a creator of that game Cinephile that we played on the show.
Yeah.
Love Corey. He's a great Letterboxd follow. Corey said, third viewing was the best one yet, the most emotionally affecting and intellectually engaging. I hope that all blockbuster filmmakers not named Cameron or Nolan are walking out of this with their tail between their legs. This is how it's done. Yeah, I think that there's something to be said about, like, you know, whether or not it's a home run for everybody. I think that there are a lot of people, future filmmakers and even current filmmakers, who are going to watch this movie, are going to be like, the bar has been raised quite a bit. And I'm definitely a fan of when we get moments like that, just in general. And I think that Villeneuve's done it multiple times at this point. I think Blade Runner 2049 especially kind of like lit a fire under a lot of people who are like, oh my gosh, the way that this movie blends CGI and production design is just immaculate. So, and also, like, you can take something that has been, you know, done, the Blade Runner, and you really can find a new vein of interest there that just is really captivating. I know Villeneuve has said since, he's like, man, he would never do something like Blade Runner again, like do a sequel to somebody else's movie, just because it seems like he really is just like against that at this point. He wants to do his own original work. And I think that's great for him. And I think that that makes total sense. But Blade Runner still rules. 2049, that is.
Yeah, I mean, I love that movie. And I've been anxious and curious to rewatch it, you know, because it's been a few years. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty undeniable when you see something like that, that like, this guy is on a whole other level in terms of like just making sci-fi epics. And I mean, I don't know if he does Dune Messiah. It seems like he kind of burnt himself out maybe a little bit doing these two Dune movies. So it might, if Warner Brothers is allowed to let him wait, I think he's going to try to do something smaller till I kind of like recharge a little bit. But
I would love that. Yeah.
But if he wants to spend, you know, the next several years working in Arrakis and the other cavuses of Herbert's imagination, that's totally fine. And I will say that I can imagine myself rewatching this movie somewhere later down the line and being like, Will, you dummy, this is amazing. What were you going on about, you know, back in 2024? But I got to be true to myself in this moment. And like I say, I still like the film, but I just can't share that same enthusiasm that you and a lot of people have. But I'm working my way towards it, at least. I'm trying.
I'll be honest, something kind of unique about this movie. I don't think this happens very often. I do think that if they ended it at part two, it's still a satisfying duology. Honestly, like, I think that you can just kind of leave it there. And yeah, there are loose ends and everything. There's always going to be loose ends. But also, it just says so much on its own. You could almost see a situation where it's better if they don't, like, do a third movie. And
like a Last Jedi kind of thing?
Honestly, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that like the message still works. The cautionary tale still works. And yeah, legit, like if Denis Villeneuve was like, you know what, I'm not going to do a Return of the King here, I'm just going to like leave it here, I'd be happy. I'm sure a lot of people would not be. I don't think Warner Brothers would be. But I think it could still work artistically. But with that, Should we play the Rotten Tomatoes game?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I was just going to say, I think Villeneuve is smart enough to be like, I'm not putting the cart before the horse. Like, I think he's, there's a part of him that, like, couldn't believe he could actually make this movie. Like, I think, you know, like, he still is kind of like, oh, I'm allowed to do this again? Like, people actually came to the first movie? Like, all right. So I think he's maybe treading lightly as far as, like, getting third movie. But I don't know. I mean, it seems pretty likely that third movie will happen, whether it's through Villeneuve or someone else. But yeah, I don't know. I'll be very curious to see if they adapt the Dune Messiah, because I haven't read that book, but I have heard a fair bit about it. And
yeah,
not if the first Dune is considered a hard book to adapt. The second one is, oh boy, like, you know, like that's where you get really, really into the weeds, the weird stuff with Herbert. But
yeah,
that's for another day.
Agreed. There you go. Rotten Tomatoes game time. We have 399 reviews counted. That's one of the, I think, that's one of the highest I think we've done at this point.
And I mean, we're doing the slate too, so obviously,
yeah, a lot more reviews came in. Yeah, because usually for like the big movies, it's usually around like 350 on the high end. But all right, Will Ashton, the critics have spoken. What's your prediction? What do you think the Rotten Tomatoes score is? I have a feeling you might have heard about it or seen it, but it could have changed.
So I think it's got to be like way, way high. Like, I don't see a lot of people being outright negative about the film. I can see some people being me, maybe being a little bit more muted compared, like, maybe closer to me comparatively, but I'm going to say this is like a 97%.
You went a little too high. It's actually 92%. Yeah, there's some fans out there who are just like, well, you know, it ain't it. But yeah, 92% is still extremely high. And I think especially for a movie that is, we hadn't said it yet, 2 hours and 46 minutes, so pretty long. And also a movie that is, you know, it's a sequel, it's a sci-fi movie, and it's a hard thing to please everybody with that kind of stuff, with genre stuff like that. So 92 is very impressive. All right, 5,000 plus verified ratings. What do you think for that? Audience score, I forgot to say it. This is audience score.
Yeah, yeah. Seems like audiences are really digging it, like to near like Empire Strikes Back degree. So I'm going to say 98%. I'm going to go one up my wrong rating before.
You're still going a little too high, Will Ashton. You know, 95%. Okay. I mean, look, that's still very high. Folks are taking one look at Dune Part 2 and they're like, I love sand. I love that it gets everywhere. And power to them for that. But I have seen that comparison. I find the Empire Strikes Back comparison a little annoying because I'm like, just because it's the second movie and it's good and it's sci-fi, like, so simplistic.
Space and sand and all that.
And I think it's such a different kind of sequel compared to the first, like, Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. Like, the first Star Wars is standalone. Like, you don't need a second movie necessarily. The second movie just expands everything. It's like Across the Spider-Verse. That's a better example of Empire Strikes Back, where people like the sequel even more, and it feels like it takes the first one and it turns it into a trilogy. This is completing the first movie. That is a totally different kind of sequel in so many different ways. It's more akin to something like, I don't know, Before Sunset, you know, where it's like you could do, but I think like when you finish Before Sunrise, you're like, well, like, you have to see the next movie. Like, what happens, right? And then the next movie happens, but you could end it there. And my metaphor is not working for you, is it? My comparison?
I kind of maybe get what you're saying. I do think you can watch Before Sunrise, not know about the existence of the other two movies, and be like, that's a really satisfying, lovely little indie. But it just, the fact that there's a second one where you kind of follow up later really, really works, obviously. And I think those movies kind of get a little bit better with each one in some respects, but yeah, I don't know if that's comparable to Dune Part 2.
So in this episode of Cinemaholics, John compares some of the best little sweet little, you know, humble low budget movies of all time. Okay, Cinema Score, what do you think for that one?
Cinema Score, I feel like this is just like a straight like A+.
It is not. It is an A.
Okay.
Again, you're just going too high. Folks are rolling the dice, and they're not saying snake eyes, but they're you know, close. So it's an A Cinema Score, which is still fantastic. I mean, higher than a lot of other stuff we talked about lately. But let's finish this out with Letterboxd. Now, with Letterboxd, we have 1 million watches. That has happened, I think, on movies we've talked about, but only maybe once or twice.
It's a regular salt burn.
My goodness. That is a high amount.
That was the last movie to come out that I believe crossed the 1 million mark on Letterboxd.
Saltburn?
Yeah.
What? That wasn't a million, was it?
On Letterboxd, yeah. A million people logged it. It was a big thing.
I'm talking about watched it. What?
Yeah.
1.8 million?
Yeah, yeah.
How? Why?
People wanted to see Barry's Wang.
My God. All right. Well, all that put aside, Letterboxd rating, what do you think?
I think it's a... I remember hearing it was high, but I'm going to doubt myself a bit after these last few. I'm going to say 4.4.
Oh, closer. And this time you did undersell it. It's 4.5. You're only 0.1 away, which is for Letterboxd fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, 505,000 hearts. Which is extremely high, unbelievably high. Also, it is right now number 12 on the Letterboxd top 250. That's pretty fantastic for, you know, another thing that we don't usually see. I think we can count fewer than 10 times, maybe fewer than 5 times, a movie this close to release we've talked about that's been on the top 250. So pretty incredible to see.
I'm trying to think of other examples, what like Cross Spider-Verse and Everything Everywhere All at Once, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are the main ones that come to mind for me. But all right, thank you so much for listening. We do want to do our Oscars episode. We do want to do our best movies episode. There are some more movies to come out though. So we apologize for the delays and, you know,
I mean,
hopefully, you know,
are we doing Love Lies Bleeding? Are we doing Kung Fu Panda 4?
I haven't been able to catch my screenings lately. I think the big stuff coming up that hasn't come out. There's Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I know that's on the horizon. Also the new Godzilla Kong movie that's going to be coming out. Mm-hmm. And there are a few little things that could be interesting. Love Lies Bleeding, I have heard, is good. And so I am curious about it.
If you make me watch the new Ghostbusters over Love Lies Bleeding, I'll do it, but I won't be happy about it.
Well, besides those, we do also have Problemista, which could be interesting. And
I could do A24 double feature there if you want to do that and Love Lies Bleeding.
I'd be happy to skip the American Society of Magical Negroes. No, thank you on that movie.
Yeah, I heard that wasn't very good.
I might see it just out of curiosity, but not in theaters. And then last up on my list here is Immaculate, the Sydney Sweeney movie.
Oh, yeah.
I'm kind of curious about that one. You know, she's having a moment.
Like, yeah, that's a reteam with the... Did you see The Voyeurs?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the same director. I never saw that film, but I know it's kind of gained...
It's pretty bad.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I do not like that movie.
People have been kind of coming to bat for it of late, which is interesting.
Really?
It was,
it's Rear Window, but stupid.
Okay.
I would say
that doesn't mean it's bad.
I don't think Sydney Sweeney, it doesn't do Sydney Sweeney and Justice Smith any favors. I think that they are...
Well, speaking of American Society...
I know, I was just about to say there's a connection there. But yeah, so that's what we got possibly cooking up soon. And of course, Alex Garland's Civil War. I cannot wait to see that. That's probably going to be... I'm just so curious. After what happened with that movie, Men, I'm just like, what is going to happen with this Civil War movie?
His quotes make me nervous, but the South by Southwest reactions seem to be encouraging.
Yeah, agreed. And I haven't looked too close at anything South by Southwest besides that in the American Society of Magical Negroes movie. But I will say, also coming around that same time, because that's going to be in April, but around that same time, the Fallout TV show is going to be coming out, Will Ashton. I know you don't care. I know you don't, you know, when it comes to Fallout video games and all that, you're like, no thanks, whatever. But, and the subject of shows, I do want to say Shogun has been living up to the hype. Fantastic.
I want to watch that.
It's really good.
I mean, TV-wise, I mean, you know this. I've been pulling a John Negroni. I've been watching a dang anime show from the 90s called Neon Genesis Evangelion. So that's been kind of taking up my TV time because I want to watch End of Evangelion, which is going to be in theaters Wednesday, which I've heard is very good. But yeah, I do want to get into Shogun. I want to watch all these shows that I've been putting off because of Oscar season.
Yeah, there's a bunch more for me too. But yeah, we'll have to focus in though on what we got left for just stuff that we're supposed to talk about months ago. But thank you as always for listening. Really appreciate it. And we'll be back soon. Promise. From the Internet California, I'm John Negroni.
And from the internet, Pennsylvania, I'm Will Ashton.
Will, what? Why are you banging on your desk like that? You're going to summon an angry fan.
It's the word.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.